Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
New Books in Southeast Asian Studies is sponsored by the ANU Southeast Asia Institute, the Griffith Asia Institute, the New York Southeast Asia Network, the Nordic Institute of Asian Studies, and the Sydney Southeast Asia Centre.
Welcome to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Michelle Ford, Professor of Southeast Asian Studies at the University of Sydney and a co-host of the channel. Today I'm talking to Charlotte Setiadi, an Assistant Professor of Humanities at Singapore Management University and author of Memories of Unbelonging, Ethnic Chinese Identity Politics in Post-Suharto Indonesia, published by University of Hawaii Press in 2023. Welcome, Charlotte.
Thank you for having me, Michelle. This is an honour.
It's a great pleasure. Charlotte, you note in your preface that this book is deeply personal. If it's okay, I'd like you to start by telling us a bit about your experience of 1998 and how it shaped you in both human terms and as a scholar.
Thanks for that question, Michelle. Yeah, like you said, this book was deeply personal for me to write about. And really what inspired my study, and this book came from my doctorate studies in anthropology at La Trobe University. And in 1998, I was 14 years old. I was actually not in Jakarta when the May 1998 riots happened. I was already living in Adelaide in South Australia. And I remember that day hearing news from my family, hearing news from TV, and also reading on the newspaper that Jakarta was on fire. And I think that was really traumatic for me because I didn't really understand what was happening. I knew for some time that there had been student demonstrations happening in Jakarta demanding for the fall of Suharto, President Suharto, and his New Order regime at that time. But then I realized that actually the riots that were happening in central Jakarta at that time was very much motivated, at least the ones that were concentrated around the Chinatown of Jakarta in the Glodok area, by anti-Chinese sentiments. And then news came out of anti-Chinese attacks, the violence that happens and rapes and murders that ended up being uncovered as well. And I was just really confused. I remembered feeling that I was very much, and I still do until today, feel very Indonesian. My family are Peranakan Chinese Indonesians. To those of you who don't know what Peranakan is, we're mixed heritage Chinese. So my own family, we're half Chinese, half Javanese. And I didn't really understand why this violence was being committed against ethnic Chinese, a lot of whom, like myself, felt completely Indonesian. So I think that sparked something in me. And throughout my university studies, and especially as I became interested in questions of identity and questions of nationalism through my anthropological studies, I became really interested in exploring why the ethnic Chinese, even though, like my family, I'm sixth generation Chinese, why the ethnic Chinese, although they've been in Indonesia for hundreds of years, have continued to be viewed as essential foreigners. And this question continued on even after the fall of Suharto that ended up happening in 1998. So the motivation for writing this book was very much derived from my own personal experiences. Thankfully, my family and our loved ones weren't harmed by the violence that happened in 1998. But it did affect a lot of Chinese Indonesian families and have continued to affect Chinese-Indonesian identity politics and the psyche regarding how safe and secure and how much they feel like they belong in Indonesia, which is, of course, the theme of the book.
And you start the book with an account of a particular Indonesian Chinese, an owner of a fabric shop in Pasar Tanah Abang. Her name was Alin. Can you tell us a bit about Alin and how her experience speaks to the themes of the book?
Yeah, of course. So Alin, her story was very intriguing. She was actually one of the first respondents that I interviewed when I arrived in Jakarta. So I left Jakarta in 1997. And then I came back actually 10 years later in 2007. That was my first field work. And I was a PhD student at that time. And I think I came into the interview somewhat naive. At the beginning, I knew that I was looking at Chinese-Indonesian identity politics in the post-Suharto era. So 10 years after the beginning of post-Suharto reforms, things were looking much more different for Chinese-Indonesians. Assimilationist policies that were put in place by the New Order regime had been abolished. Chinese Indonesians were allowed to form their social organizations again. They were involved in politics. Chinese names and Chinese languages were allowed to be used in public again. So things were exciting. People were celebrating Chinese New Year. And I think I was filled with positivity and the promise that things were becoming much better. And I think that underlined my assumptions as well, that policy changes at the executive level, at the national level, would at least almost automatically translate to better interethnic relations at the grassroots level. So when I visited Alin, and she is third or fourth generation Chinese living in Jakarta, and like you mentioned before, she had a fabric shop in Pasar Tanah Abang in central Jakarta. When I went and interviewed her, she was actually quite anxious about our topic because I was asking her about her identity as Chinese, her sense of belonging, all that, which is related to my book. What surprised me about the interview with Alin at that time was the realization that I think I did not really have before, that 10 years after the beginning of the post-Suharto era, and despite the abolishing of assimilationist policies, actually, the relationship between ethnic Chinese and non-Chinese Indonesians were still problematic. And that got me interested in looking a bit more about the role of collective memory and how it influenced post-Suharto ethnic Chinese identity politics.
And we'll come back to this question of collective identity. But before we get there, you talk in the book about the Chinese problem. What is the Chinese problem and where does its genesis lie?
Yeah, so the Chinese problem, in Indonesian, we call it masalah Cina. It's a literal translation of the Chinese problem. And it basically describes what I was telling you about, how the ethnic Chinese have been in Indonesia for many, many, many generations. Historical records suggest that they've been in Indonesia, in the Indonesian archipelago, from at least the 17th century. They migrated over different waves of migration in the 18th century, 19th century, and early 20th century. Yet, despite different degrees of acculturation, intermarriage, the majority of Chinese Indonesians speaking Indonesian, and despite the fact that many Chinese Indonesians feel wholly Indonesian and very nationalistic, and many Chinese Indonesians involved in state making and in the beginnings of the Indonesian nation state, the Chinese were still regarded as essentially foreign. So the Chinese problem was actually one of the justifications of this New Order regime when they put in place assimilationist policies when Suharto took power in 1965, where those assimilationist policies were intended to neutralize the Chinese Indonesians, to naturalize them into Indonesian society and to eliminate the Chinese problem. So when we talk about the Chinese problem, that's what we mean.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because on the one hand, this assimilationist urge was so clearly evident. On the other hand, the Suharto regime really continued to differentiate very strongly between Chinese and non-Chinese Indonesians. Can you give us a sense? I'm sure a lot of listeners already know this, but for those who don't, can you give us a sense of what day-to-day life of Chinese was like under the New Order?
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. I think the great tragedy and the great paradox of the New Order regime's assimilationist policy towards the Chinese was the very fact that what it did mostly was further accentuate just how foreign and how different the Chinese were. More than anything else, because the Chinese were the only ethnic group, the only non-indigenous ethnic group that were in need of naturalization. They were the only targets of assimilation. Of course, there's the backstory as well, which I won't go into here, but there's fascinating books that have been written about it, about the communist implications attached to the Chinese at that time, because the Chinese were linked with China. They were viewed with suspicion as potential fifth pillars of communist China, one of the reasons for assimilation. But even though the New Order regime forced the ethnic Chinese to do things such as change their Chinese names into Indonesianized sounding names, for instance, my family name was, the Chinese surname was Chi, and my father and his brother changed our family name into Satyadi when 1967 happened. And even though these assimilationist policies were in place, actually the Chinese were singled out as economic animals and as the business cronies of the regime. One of the reasons this happened was because the Chinese were not allowed to join the military. They were not allowed in the civil service. They were not allowed in any political realm. So really, the only field available to them is commerce and trade, which had the effect of enforcing the stereotype that all Chinese were economic animals. In the day-to-day life, the ethnic Chinese have a special citizenship document called the SBKRI. In English, it's the Letter of Proof of Indonesian Citizenship. No other ethnic group were required to have this document, and this document was needed for everything from getting your driver's license and identity cards to getting married and registering births and deaths. So the assimilation policy, like I said before, actually had the opposite effect of highlighting just how problematic the Chinese really were.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because although many of these, the aspects that you've just described did change after Reformasi, a feeling of difference really has continued, right? As the story of Alin suggested. What role do you think collective memory of this anti-Chinese discrimination in the Suharto period play in this Chinese identity politics since Suharto?
Yeah, so as I mentioned before, when you asked me about the personal aspects of my book, Michelle, I told you that actually when May 1998 happened, I was not in Indonesia. So in many ways, my memories of the anti-Chinese violence that happened in 1998 were secondary memories. And I realized that for the younger generation, they're not so young anymore now because it's been 25 years since the end of Suharto regime. But many of the Chinese that I interviewed post-1998, including Alin, the character we were talking about before, they were either too young themselves to remember exactly what happened in the anti-Chinese riots, or they weren't directly affected by it. And I was intrigued actually by those who experience secondary memories like this. Throughout Chinese history in Indonesia, there's been big episodes of anti-Chinese violence. Goes as far back as the 18th century, for instance, the big anti-Chinese killings of 1740, and then periodic violence. There's a saying in Indonesia that every 25 years, you would have a cyclical event where there would be an anti-Chinese riot or anti-Chinese violence, right? And it's kind of just accepted. And in more recent memory, you had the 1965 anti-communist killings, which included anti-Chinese attacks, and of course, 1998 riots. So I was interested in how these periodic anti-Chinese violence were remembered by the post-Suharto generation, the generation that for the first time in over 30 years had the opportunity to become Chinese again. They can be Chinese, right? But the questions are, how do you assume an identity or reassume an identity that has been quote-unquote lost through assimilation policies of the past 30 years, right? And how do you reconstruct your identity as an ethnic group and represent yourself in the realm of identity politics with tragic memories and with rather violent memories that make you suspicious of non-Chinese Indonesians, right? And those were the questions that really underlied my entire book. So this book is not really concerned about, it's not a history book, so it's not a factual recounting or archival research about exactly what happened. It's a book about what people remember and how what people remember gets articulated in their choices, their everyday behaviors, and in their forms of political and creative representation.
Now, speaking of everyday behaviors, your second chapter focuses on the experience of a Totok family living in a Chinese enclave in Kelapa Gading. Can you tell us about them and what their lives say about racial inclusion and exclusion in the everyday?
Absolutely. So anyone who has been to Kelapa Gading in Jakarta would know that it's a foodie heaven, and it's also known as the unofficial Chinatown of Jakarta. So I became intrigued to write about this particular enclave because this is perhaps the biggest ethnic Chinese middle upper class residential enclave that we have in Jakarta. There are quite a number of those located in sort of like the inner suburb area, although more and more now they're branching out to the outer perimeters of Jakarta. And the Tanuwijayas, the family that hosted me during my stay in Kelapa Gading, is quite a typical Totok, or by Totok we mean pure Chinese, so they're not of mixed heritage. So their ancestry, at least they believe that their ancestry are pure Chinese. They no longer speak Mandarin, but their family, their Christian family, they live in this nice middle upper class enclave in northern Jakarta, where the majority of the people who live in this residential enclave are all ethnic Chinese families as well, with very similar profiles as them. So they're middle upper class Chinese. And their lives in many ways are unremarkable, at least according to them. They were very perplexed as to why I was even interested in spending a bit of time with them. But they really do typify the segregated lives of middle upper class ethnic Chinese who in their daily contact really don't have that much contact with non-Chinese Indonesians. From the church that they go to, the schools that the children and the universities the children go to, all dominated by ethnic Chinese of their demographic. And I was particularly intrigued, and I dedicated quite a section of the chapter into talking about this, their relationship with the non-Chinese that they include in their lives, mostly in the form of the help that they have in their lives, right? Domestic workers, drivers, security guards, and all that, right? And what intrigued me about their existence is that the very group of people that families like the Tanuwiharja don't mix with and in many ways also don't trust because of their own experiences of the terror that they experienced in May 1998 are the lower class non-Chinese Indonesians, right? Like the pribumi who live outside of Kelapa Gading. A lot of them live in middle and lower class kampungs around the complex. Yet they also trust them intimately in their day-to-day runnings of their lives as very trusted maids, as drivers, as security guards that they employ to guarantee their safety. So the paradox here is really quite jarring to see, although it's become so normalized in places like Kelapa Gading, that to me, they symbolize what I call intimate inclusion and exclusion in terms of allowing how much contact exists between the Chinese and the non-Chinese in their lives.
The next chapter explores racial segregation within the education system. How does this affect how young Chinese learn about Chineseness?
So I mentioned before, for families like the Tanuwiharjas who live in Kelapa Gading, their children, in the case of the family that I mentioned before, one child was at this point at university, and I think another child was just about to enter university or in high school. So they go to not Chinese schools as such, not in the way, Chinese schools, not in the way like, for instance, what we have in Malaysia or Singapore, as in Chinese vernacular schools. These are Indonesian-speaking schools, mostly private schools, and very much integrated within the Indonesian national education system. I'll tell you a little bit, and I promise not too long, about the history of Chinese segregated education in Indonesia. So in 1965, when the assimilationist policies kicked in, one of the first things that the government did was to close all Chinese vernacular schools. So these are schools that were predominantly delivered in Mandarin, and predominantly by Chinese teachers, and they existed in the 1950s and before as part of outside of the national education system. That all ended when the assimilationist policies came in. Where do the Chinese send their kids if they can't send them to Chinese schools anymore? They mostly opted for Christian private schools, particularly those in urban areas, because of two reasons. One, they don't want to send their kids to state schools because that would, one, involve more contact between their children and non-Chinese children, most of whom are Muslims. And of course, there's a big distrust towards the state after the assimilationist policies and after what happened. So Christian private schools became the choice for most Chinese families, at least in Jakarta, where I conducted my fieldwork. And over time, particular private Chinese schools, private Christian schools in Jakarta became known as Chinese schools or Chinese universities. Now, your question before was about how this affects what they know about their Chineseness. One of the major takeaways is, even though the content of the education is exactly the same in many cases because of the national curriculum, what it did was to normalize differences, normalize the segregation between the Chinese and non-Chinese children. The milieu or the social environment in which Chinese and non-Chinese kids grew up in were segregated. And even in situations where Chinese and non-Chinese kids do go to school together, yes, they do become friends, but there are still some essential differences that were considered to be impassable, such as, for instance, because of religious differences, it's very difficult for Chinese and non-Chinese young people who want to get married to be able to be together, for instance, right? Because until today, you can't marry under different religions in Indonesia. So while the schools themselves are not official Chinese schools, they did enforce, in the book, I use Bordeaux's term, the habitus, right? Like they did enforce the normalization of the segregated habitus between the Chinese social environments and the non-Chinese social environments. And that has been one of the reasons why, even after 25 years of reform in Indonesia, we still see this sense of essential difference between the Chinese and non-Chinese.
You then turn your attention to filmmakers and artists who focused on their personal experiences as ethnic Chinese in Indonesia. What do we learn from the questions they ask in their work?
So I think this must have been my favorite chapter in the whole book. Certainly, it was the most fun I had while doing fieldwork. So this was quite unexpected because I don't regard myself as an art historian or somebody who talks extensively about contemporary art. But when I was in Jakarta, especially in 2008, that was 10 years after the fall of Suharto. So there was a lot of artistic activity that was happening by filmmakers, by visual artists that wanted to commemorate the event of the 10 years anniversary of the fall of Suharto. And a lot of these artists were Chinese Indonesians. And they made short films, they made works of art, they made feature long films about the experiences of being Chinese under the new order and after the fall of Suharto. And this was really interesting because for 30 years under the new order, like in other aspects of Chinese Indonesian lives, a lot of it was hidden from the public. Whenever you see an ethnic Chinese character on TV or portrayed in magazines, they're usually sort of stereotype essentialized Chinese characters as either like a rich person or somebody speaking with a thick Chinese accent and playing a rich, you know, a rich tradesman or something like that, right? For the first time, you saw realistic representations and quite sad representations of a new generation of Chinese Indonesians asking pertinent questions about what it means to rediscover their Chineseness, actually. You have really quite touching films. One that I highlighted in my film was a short film, actually, that was done in 2008 by a Bandung female film director. Her name is Aryani Darmawan. She made a short film called Sugiharti Halim. And it's a very funny, but simple, very witty film about a young woman who just hates her name, Sugiharti Halim. And in the film, she kept questioning herself and the people she was having dinner with, why have I been cursed with such a weird name, right? Like, look at my face, I'm Chinese, yet I have this like very Javanese name called Sugiharti Halim. So from this comical exploration of her name, we actually learned about the name changing policy of 1965 and how, because Chinese Indonesians were required to assume names that were quote unquote unnatural for them, it highlighted the unbelonging of their names even more. So these kinds of films really asked important questions about the challenges of reclaiming Chineseness in the post-Suharto era. Another artist that I really admire, Tintin Wulia, her entire body of work, and she's a prominent artist. She's, for instance, represented Indonesia in the Venice Biennale, for instance. Her work explores the notion of bureaucratic discrimination, where she would paint huge murals depicting her family's citizenship document, highlighting and prompting more questions about how the Chinese were the only ones that were required to undergo this assimilation. So to me, the young filmmakers and artists are really important examples of the kind of activism, not just political activism, but activism through the creative arts, through everyday cultural expressions, that if not providing answers, then asking more questions about what Chineseness really means for a generation that is now rediscovering themselves.
And of course, then you turn to the question of political participation itself. And this is an area where there has been a dramatic shift since Reformasi. You talk about the case of Ahok in the chapter, and of course that's emblematic, but I'm actually interested in your thoughts about less prominent forms of Chinese involvement in politics since the fall of Suharto.
Yeah, absolutely. So for listeners that may not know very much about the case of Chinese Indonesians, or at least the history of it, the most recent case that most international audiences would have heard about Chinese Indonesians is probably the 2017 anti-Ahok demonstrations in Jakarta. This was the case where then Jakarta Governor Basuki Cahayapurnama, also known by his Hakkanese nickname Ahok, he was accused of committing blasphemy against Islam. And what ended up happening was a series of mass demonstrations organized by right-wing Islamist groups in Jakarta involving, over 500,000 protesters, the biggest religious political gathering in recent Indonesian history. So it made waves. Ahok himself lost the Jakarta governorship in the subsequent election that happened, and he spent 2.5 years in jail for blasphemy. So this was an important event for Chinese Indonesians living in Jakarta in particular, because it reminded them of two things. One, that anti-Chinese violence can happen so quickly and so easily with what seems to be the slightest of provocations. And second of all, it reminds them that despite what was then almost 25 years of post-Suharto reforms, anti-Chinese sentiments is still very much alive and well and just still simmering under the surface. That's one of the takeaways of the anti-Ahok demonstration. But to go back to your question before, Ahok is perhaps the most prominent of all the ethnic Chinese politicians since the fall of Suharto. But actually, there are many other ethnic Chinese politicians that have been very much involved. They've been elected to parliament. They've served as national senators. And I mean, both national parliament and also regional parliament. So ever since the first direct elections in 2009, Chinese Indonesians have been active participants and they've got good representation in parliament. So if we compare, for instance, at the moment, we have about 15 members of parliament who are of ethnic Chinese descent, and that's quite proportional to the number of ethnic Chinese living in Indonesia, right? Although Ahok is the most well-known, one of the main points of the chapter on politics in my book is to say that Chinese Indonesians have been very active participants in the political sphere at various levels of government, but also through socio-political organizations. So this is one of the areas where Chinese Indonesian activism has been really quite successful, and they've had some big breakthroughs. So for instance, because of lobbying by big Chinese Indonesian organizations such as INTI and PSMTI, which is basically a collection of Chinese Indonesian clan associations, they've successfully lobbied, for instance, for Chinese New Year to be regarded as a national holiday. They have also forged good relationships with government officials, and one by one, lobbying for assimilationist policies from the New Order period to be abolished. So there are a lot of examples of political participation by the ethnic Chinese, not just the national prominent level like AHOC, I don't see that slowing down, actually. And I hope to see similar results as well in the 2024 elections.
Yeah, it's really quite remarkable how quickly Chinese Indonesians have reclaimed that part of society in the post-Suharto period. Another political question that you deal with in your last substantive chapter is the role of China as a world power and how that has affected the position of Indonesian Chinese within Indonesia. We've seen a shift in the relationship between Indonesia and China as countries. But as you point out, there's still an inherent suspicion about the loyalties of Indonesian Chinese in relation to Indonesia as a country and to China as the ancestral homeland. And of course, we see similar concerns some in places like Singapore about different ethnic groups. But in the Indonesian context, how can we understand the role of China in shaping Indonesian Chinese identities now?
Yeah, this is the big question, isn't it? Particularly with the rise of China now, and everybody is interested in seeing what China does next in the Southeast Asian region, which is, of course, very strategic, and also how China will capitalize on or at least utilize its 64 million strong ethnic Chinese, overseas ethnic Chinese population, right? So a lot of people, even if they don't know about Chinese Indonesian history, told me that they're very interested in this chapter. The Chinese in Indonesia have had a problematic history as well in terms of their relationship with China, right? So actually, I want to take us back a little bit further into 20th century history here, where at different points of different historical periods and important events that were happening in China, Chinese Indonesians were also invested in it one way or another. For instance, when the Republican China cause was being championed by Sun Yat-sen, he famously went a tour of Japan, of the United States, of Southeast Asian colonies, and met with ethnic Chinese leaders at that time to raise funds, right, to fund for the Republican cause, the revolutionary cause in China. So this relationship between China and its overseas Chinese communities, and in trying to stir up the pan-nationalist sentiments of overseas Chinese in order to help causes in China, is nothing new, actually. It's not just something that China is doing now. They've been doing this for a long time. But for the ethnic Chinese in Indonesia, I think closeness in their relationship with China at different points have been both a curse and a blessing. I guess the golden rule in terms of China and Chinese-Indonesian relations is this. Whenever the Chinese state is favorably in Indonesia, it doesn't necessarily cause ethnic Chinese in Indonesia to be viewed more favorably. But whenever there's bad publicity about China, it always affects Chinese-Indonesians negatively, right? And the big lesson here was, of course, from 1965, because of the suspicions of Chinese-Indonesians being China's fifth pillar was one of the reasons why we saw anti-Chinese pogroms at that time, and also the assimilation policy that ended up happening. So a lot of Chinese Indonesians are very wary about appearing to be too close to China. Of course, a lot of Chinese Indonesians, and I talked about this in my chapter 6 as well, particularly those in the business sector, particularly those dealing at the high levels of commerce, are very excited about the opportunities that the Chinese market brings and how they may be able to utilize their ethnicity and their clan networks. Their, in Chinese studies, we call it Quanxi networks, or oftentimes in the West, it's also been called as the bamboo network, or the network of overseas Chinese businesses and their relationship with China, how they can cultivate this ethnic Chinese transnational relationship to benefit each other's businesses, right? And certainly we see this in Indonesia as well. There's organizations like Indonesia-China Business Council or the Chinese Indonesian Entrepreneur Association that would frequently make visits to China and host visits by Chinese delegations, and are also involved in state-to-state negotiations or meetings between the two countries, right? So that's one aspect of it. And certainly ethnicity can be a currency here in dealings with China. But on the other hand, there are also many that are really worried about how this may be perceived by non-Chinese Indonesians, right? Like one respondent told me that he was very worried about the fact that he doesn't want non-Chinese Indonesians to, number one, strengthen their perception that all Chinese Indonesians are rich entrepreneurs, and number two, that the Chinese's loyalty will always be with mainland China, right? So this is a double-edged sword. And from time to time as well, issues like this would flare up again, such as, for instance, during the anti-AUG demonstrations in 2017, where one of the hoaxes that were going on around at that time alleged that AUG got his political campaigning money from China, that he's actually a Chinese agent, right? Like a lot of these kinds of conspiracy theories. Now, China is now Indonesia's number one trade partner. I think they're the second largest foreign direct investor in Indonesia, if I'm not wrong. So China is only going to be more prominent in Indonesia. And with Chinese infrastructure projects like we see around the world, we also see the importation of Chinese workers. During the COVID pandemic, Indonesia was very much heavily reliant on the Sinovac vaccine that, of course, was manufactured in China, combined with trends in Indonesia itself, such as heightened ethno-nationalism, the rise of conservative Islam in politics. You know, we see potential fault lines here, right? Where oftentimes xenophobic narratives about protecting national interests, protecting Indonesian wealth is also intertwined with anti-Chinese narratives. So it's going to continue to be a tricky issue, both for the Chinese and Indonesian governments to navigate, but also for Chinese Indonesians in terms of where to place themselves in this growing and lucrative relationship between Indonesia and China.
Thanks for walking us through the substantive chapters of the book. I'd like to turn now to some of the more theoretical and methodological concerns. Your core theoretical preoccupation is with this intersection between collective memory and ethno-nationalist politics. What would you say is your key scholarly contribution on this question?
Yeah, so both fields are really huge fields, right? Collective memory and also ethno-nationalist politics. My interest here is to illustrate from the Chinese-Indonesian case how the two are really intertwined with one another, right? That ethno-nationalist politics in all countries around the world are very much shaped by the collective memories of its people. And at the same time, individual and group collective memories are also shaped by the circumstances and by the socio-political environment that have been shaped by ethno-nationalist narratives. From the Chinese-Indonesian case, I wanted to showcase how part of the reason why the Chinese have continued to be a quote-unquote problem in contemporary Indonesia is because of this collective memory of distrust, because of this collective memory of perceived essential difference that continues to exist in Indonesia today, and how the core of Indonesian ethno-nationalist politics as being rooted in indigeneity, in nativism, has not changed. So as long as Indonesian nationalism and Indonesian belonging continues to be defined by native belonging, which is that you have to belong to an indigenous tribe in Indonesia, then the Chinese will never be regarded as true Indonesians. They will never truly belong in Indonesia. And that will continue to shape collective memory for generations to come, both for the Chinese and the non-Chinese.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because at the same time, Reformasi brought echoes of that experience to many other Indonesians who were living perhaps outside of the areas where their ethnic group was dominant, but of course nothing of the same extent. But I wanted to stick on this question of geography for a moment. Geography is a really important determinant of the experience of individual Chinese Indonesians, especially in the New Order period. Yet most of our understanding of that period, and also maybe of now, is shaped by the situation in Jakarta and other parts of Java. Your research for this book focused primarily on Jakarta, but you did travel to some other cities. When you were designing the study, did you think about that geographical nuance to start with, or did that perception evolve over time?
Yeah, absolutely. When I first embarked on the study, I definitely did not just want to do Jakarta, actually, because I'm from Jakarta. Most of the people that I know live in Jakarta, and I was really afraid that my own subjectivity, my own comfort with my and my family's social milieu would very much affect and heavily bias my study. So I really wanted to do fieldwork in Medan and Surabaya as well as Jakarta as well. But it soon became very apparent to me that there are just too many regional differences that are all very interesting to talk about if I were to cover multiple cities and try to fit it all in one book. Michelle, I know you've done work yourself in various parts of Indonesia and particularly in the Riau Islands with the Chinese. They're so interesting in terms of their own local cultural acculturations, their own dynamics with their local environments and all that. And I knew that I couldn't capture all that in the book. And I hope, despite of that, my book still conveys the heterogeneity of Chinese Indonesians. But I decided to focus on Jakarta because at that time, I decided to focus on national level changes that were happening as post-assimilation politics were starting to be expressed through mainstream politics and large organizations that were mainly operating from Jakarta, which is the reason why. As you know, Indonesia is quite Jakarta-centric. And Indonesia, in terms of the Chinese Indonesians, they're most represented in terms of the different backgrounds, different classes, different ethno-linguistic groups in Jakarta. So Jakarta was a really convenient and also really fascinating petri dish in a way to analyze the diversity of Chinese Indonesian lives. But of course, it's still very limited in that it doesn't capture the regional difference that I hope to explore in my future works, actually. So yeah, the geography and the Jakarta-centric national politics definitely shaped the book more so than what I intended at the beginning.
It's funny. One of my favorite things to do is to take Jakarta Chinese to the Riau Islands and just see their lack of comprehension.
Absolutely. I'm that person whenever I go to like a place like Riau Islands and somebody tries to speak to me in Hokkien or in Teochew and I just have no clue.
I don't mean just linguistically. I mean about so many aspects of the sort of the much more integrated sense of Chineseness in the islands, for example. And related to that, I also wanted to talk to you about your focus on upper and middle class Chinese. And you recognize this in the book. And again, referring to my own experience, if you could indulge me, one of the things I really loved about the work we did on Chinese in the Riau Islands was the diversity of their class positions and how much that disrupted prevailing stereotypes of Chinese as being rich. How different do you think your analysis would have been if you'd engaged more with lower class Chinese Indonesians?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I wish this was a question that I could have engaged with more in the book. I think if I had to change some things about the book, maybe I would have included parts of the class diversity of Chinese Indonesians more if I could do my fieldwork all over again. But certainly, I think the core arguments of the book would still be the same, because from at least from my experience of conducting fieldwork outside of Jakarta or even in Jakarta with Chinese not from the middle upper classes, show a different kind of relational dynamics with their non-Chinese neighbors. For instance, even among the interviews that I conducted in Glodok, so those of you who've been to the Glodok Chinatown area of Jakarta, it's predominantly lower middle class Chinese that live in those areas, actually. Their stories were similar in many ways with Chinese from the upper classes in terms of the fear that they felt during May 1998 and all that. But they also shared with me stories of incredible solidarity between them and their Muslim and non-Chinese neighbors during times of riots, right? Like, and from time to time, you would hear stories like this about how the only reason why they were able to escape from their ruko or their shop house and from their houses during the riots was because a kind Muslim neighbor smuggled them out of the area, right? So, and I think the book would have captured much more of these inter-ethnic class solidarity and perhaps more similar struggles in terms of having to deal with the state bureaucracy, having to deal with premans, for instance, or local thugs asking for protection money equally from Chinese and non-Chinese traders. I think we would have seen that a lot more. And of course, I think it would have showcased more the internal differences as well that exist between Chinese of different classes. Like, for instance, one of the things that some of my lower class Chinese respondents told me, like, for instance, when I did fieldwork among the China Benteng or the Benteng Chinese that live in the western outskirts of Jakarta, told me is that actually people oppress us, rich people oppress us, no matter whether they're Chinese or non-Chinese. the last place that I lived at, and we were in Indonesian, we call it digusur, or we were evicted from the land that we were occupying. The owner of the consortium that evicted us were fellow ethnic Chinese, right? Like, they didn't care that we were also ethnic Chinese, for instance. They would also say things like, you know, during the times of riots, richer Chinese have the luxury of boarding a plane to Singapore or, you know, putting their money and their families elsewhere, but we can't go anywhere. So actually, whenever something happens at the national level or a prominent Chinese ends up doing something that gives all Chinese a bad name, then it's actually the lower class Chinese that feel the brunt of it, right? So there are these nuances that I hope came through at least a little bit in the book, but certainly the heterogeneity of the class differences would have been accentuated more. The focus on the different classes have been different in the book.
And I guess it just means there's a lot more fascinating research out there to do.
True.
So to round off, Charlotte, of course, we can't really complete a discussion of your methodology without returning to the question of your positionality. Reflecting on your research, on your analysis, how do you think your ethnicity, but also your personal life trajectory, influenced your relationship both with the field site of Jakarta and Indonesia more broadly, but also with individual informants?
Yeah, I think talking about myself in the book was something that I, at least initially, wasn't comfortable with. In fact, on the first draft of the book, I didn't include any prologue or any insights into my own life at all, or any personal stories that had to do with my experience of growing up as Chinese Indonesian. I think I was too insecure to do that. I felt like it was self-indulgent, and I felt like who would be interested in hearing about this? It's something that I wasn't interested in talking about. But thanks to my editors, and also thanks to readers who knew me and my writing style and the subject as well, said that, you know, you can't hide from the fact that you're Chinese Indonesian too, right? The motivation, like I mentioned to you before, of me even doing the study was because of my own memories of May 1998 and my own feelings of unbelonging that I experienced afterwards. So I decided that in anthropology, we call it autoethnography as my primary methodology, because frankly, as soon as I turn up into a field site for an interview, by looking at me, people already judge how they would interact with me, right? Like, they would see that I'm a, at that time, young Chinese Indonesian woman, and it shapes how much they trust me. It shapes how much they think I could relate to what they were saying. You know, respondents would say things like, oh, you understand, right? Our people this, our people that, we would do this, we would do that, and very much including me as part of their narrative because they believe that I understood what they were talking about, and I did. So there was no running away from that, I think. And also, growing up in Australia, I spent my formative years, until now I still identify as an Australian as well, also shaped my understanding and my frame of reference about things like multicultural society, things like about civic society, and also gave me a little bit of a distance because I hadn't lived in Jakarta since I was 13 years old. So this insider, but also outsider, native, foreign dichotomy was very interesting for me to navigate. And I think, well, I hope at least, that it gave me a more objective perspective of how to frame my respondent stories and also help me in examining phenomena that to me are very close to home.
Well, thanks so much, Charlotte, for your insights into identity politics in Indonesia. I'm sure our listeners have really enjoyed that, as indeed I have. But before we wrap up, do you want to tell us a bit about what you're working on now?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on this podcast, Michelle. It's been a great honor. So now I'm working on something a little bit different. I'm still very much interested in Chinese identity politics, but I think I'm going to leave that for a little bit. So I'm still very much interested in Indonesian identity politics, and I'm planning for my next book. I can't believe I'm talking about a next book already. Plan to be about Indonesian diaspora politics globally. So that's one thing that I'm working on. And also still about Ethnic Chinese and the Rise of China. I am continuing on with my broader research about China's soft power efforts among ethnic Chinese communities, this time in Southeast Asia, not just in Indonesia. So looking at countries in particular, such as Malaysia and the Philippines. So that's what I'll be working on for the foreseeable future.
Well, I look forward to reading some more about that work. Charlotte Sediadi, thanks for joining us on New Books in Southeast Asian Studies to discuss Memories of Unbelonging, Ethnic Chinese Identity Politics in Post-Suharto Indonesia. You've been listening to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. If you've enjoyed this episode, you can listen to hundreds of other conversations about Southeast Asia-related books on this channel. You can download or stream these interviews free of charge from the New Books Network website or subscribe through your favourite podcast app. I look forward to joining you again before too long for another conversation about a new book in Southeast Asian Studies.